BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Five Lives Rugby Union Daily with Chris Jones.
Rugby Union Daily, match week 5 of the Six Nations. We are building up to Super Saturday, the grand finale. Scotland go to Dublin, Wales host Italy, and England are in France. They play in Lyon against Le Bleu. And today, another episode from our rivalry series. It is all about England against France. And no better man to talk about this great fixture than the World Cup winning captain, twice a Grand Slam winner, 13 times. Martin Johnson, you played against France. That sounds about
it, that
right.
Many?
13, 8 wins, 5 losses.
Yeah, we didn't win in Paris that often in the 90s, to be honest. We got beaten a couple of times there.
And also, the coach who masterminded wins over France in 2009 and in 11 on the way to a Six Nations Championship. So there is so much, Martin Johnson, to get into about this fixture. It's a fixture that said magnificence, brilliance, violence.
Brilliant violence. The crunch. Can't say that. I
mean, but it's true. We'll talk about that. We're going to talk to you about England France. What immediately comes to mind before we go through the fixture and pick out some highlights and maybe some lowlights too?
Yeah, I think as a kid watching them play at home at the old Parc de Prance, although it's still there, say old. They used to have the footage from inside the tunnel, which you didn't get anywhere else, I don't think, at that point. And they had these glass doors, and you had this picture from them inside the tunnel, and the guys all coming out to play. And I love that stadium. It's a concrete 70s, 60s concrete bowl. Shouldn't be beautiful, but it is. It has its own beauty. And the atmosphere there was just, you could tell if France got rolling, you know, this is the days of Serge Blanco and Estève on the wing and all these guys. If they got rolling, you could just, the whole thing would just, raise up. And they were almost irresistible at that point when they got going. Yeah, so there was just something very different and very special about it. They'd come out in their blue and they looked like they were just that bit different from the other five nations, mm-hmm. as was teams then. And I remember when I first played in the mid-90s, and you've got friends in the stand and whatever, and they all came out and said, you know what, whatever the capacity was, it was fuller than that because people were just getting in without tickets and sitting in the aisles. They were just sitting in the aisles. So the whole place was, you couldn't move because everyone was sitting in the aisles. So it was all that sort of slightly chaotic French stuff going on. But of all the stadia to run out in, that one was, you know, they'd whistle, the bands would be there. There was just a different, they're all great. All the Five Nations stadia are great, but that was just different. I was talking the other day that even the trip to the ground was different because the French police, they'd be kicking cars out the way. it was an entertainment in itself watching those boys get you through the Parisian traffic. There was always that thought, this is one step away from total madness.
we'll get into some of the madness.
This is one step away from...
Well, I think sometimes it went full-blown madness. First England-France game was in 1906, so a bit later than, say, the Scotland-England rivalry started, 71, Wales 1881, Ireland 1875. But 1906, it's got a rich history. France had to wait until 1927, their 17th attempt, I think it was, before they got a win against England. But for you growing up, before we get into when you came on the international scene in 93, the 70s was Welsh-dominated, wasn't it? But then it started to turn to French domination.
They were still good.
They were still good, and often, you know, Wales had to beat France to win the title, or they occasionally lost to France. But through that 80s period, Martin, slams in 81 and 87, a host of other titles, some of them shared, that was when French rugby really started to announce itself internationally?
Yeah, I mean, I can remember England winning there in the early 80s. They won in 80, won the Grand Slam. In 82, I remember that one distinctly. I was playing rugby by then. Jean-Pierre Rive was the face of French rugby. I mean, you know...
And for those who don't know Jean-Pierre Rive, flowing,
if you don't know Jean-Pierre Rive, get on YouTube, right? Long, flowing locks, generally with a head wound, bleeding about 5 pints onto the floor, it seemed. And then, you know, Blanco came through. And I remember reading, I used to read the sort of autobiographies in the early 80s when I was a kid, and they'd talk about that French pack of the 70s. I was chatting with an ex-player about it the other day, actually, it was Frank Cotton, about Gerard Scholli and Papillon Boer and all these guys. I mean, they were just henchmen, what was Scholli? Was he the boxing champion of the French armed forces or whatever he was? You'd be going, oh, Yeah, what sort of day is today going to be? There was always that. There was always that that contrast between their beautiful flowing rugby and then their, because they always loved to scrummage, the brutality of the game. And,
well, that was
and
Brian Moore's line, wasn't it?
Yeah,
brilliant,
yeah,
but brutal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That, because they love to scrummage. It's a big part of their psyche. And you know, when you play them, it was a different level up front of scrummaging. They were the team. You'd watch every bit of rugby you could because you didn't get as much now. But if France were on, oh wow, you'd just be into that, because they could just do things that no one else could do. The way they played the game was different. It was they played the early pass. Guys would be running at angles, you know, and they could go 50, 60, 70 yards with just this flowing rugby. So it was always the game to watch. France, and then by the time I'm really sort of getting into it in the mid 80s, we weren't, you know, going to Paris was like, we're going to concede, you know, I think we got done with maybe 30 points in 84, 86 again, you know, it was a heavy defeat, but they had a very established team at that point. I can remember those guys. 87, the first World Cup, they got to the final, you could name that team. It and they had a second row called Alan Laurier. People always say, oh, what's your favourite try ever? I'm thinking you're going to talk about Gareth in 73 and whatever. And I say, my favourite try ever is Alan Laurier's try against Australia in 87 World Cup semi-final. Because he wasn't a hugely tall guy by the modern standards. And he was France, traditionally, their second rows were more grafters, not line-out guys. They were more scrummaging, grafting guys. And the back row would be the line-out athletes.
It's kind of the same today, in a way.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. They go back to it, yeah. Mm. So he was a number four out of the old school, right? A face like, you know, he'd just been trampled daily for the last 20 years. And the Aussies threw this ball in defensively. It's about 5 metres out. They threw it in. They had a big second row. I think it was Bill Campbell, 6'8". So he's won the ball easily. He's brought it down. And Alan Laurier just ripped it off him. You could see him heaving it out of this mall, like 2, 3, 4 big heaves. And he it comes out and he takes it up the blind side. And whoever tries to tackle him, he just sort of lifts him up with his head and smashes the ball over the line. And he's just gone, that guy has scored that try with just force of will. Well, Australia have won the line out. They're looking to kick it. And he's just said, no, I'm having that. And then I'm going to get it. And I'm going to smash it over the line. And there's nothing you can do. So that's my try of all time.
That's the same try, same game. There was one of the tries of all time.
Yeah, you'll remember that one. But no, you don't get to the end bit without Alan Laurier doing that bit.
For sure. So 83 to 88, I think France 1-5, drew 1. Dominant over England. And then it started to turn.
Yeah.
Wins in 89 and 90. And then I think for people say my age growing up, one of our first memories would be that 91 quarter final. Yeah. You know, the tackle of Mickey Skinner, Blanco and Heslop, the great try when Gus Scott went through, Carling's try at the end. And then 92, French try to get their revenge. And the operative word, I know we talk about the brilliance of both the sides, but it was violent back then, wasn't it? You came in 93, but it was off the back of some really aggressively physical matches, and a lot of it spilt over, didn't it?
Yeah, well, we sort of, the tide turned, didn't it? The England won. I meant they beat them in 89 at Twickenham. Will was captain. It was the start, really, of the modern England era. I watched that with England under 19s. We were together in camp. We watched that. England beat France. Wow. The next year they beat them handily in Paris, and suddenly I think the world's changed. In 91 we beat them for the Grand Slam at Twickenham. Then the World Cup quarter final, which is a famous game, and all those things. So 92, I was in the B team. I made my debut for England B, and we'd play at the stadium next door to Parc des Princes Jean Bouin at lunchtime. So we beat them at lunchtime in the B team, and that was a big game as well, because France have got good players. They will, or even when they were struggling a few years ago to put it together, they will always have good players. And I remember the team meeting before, and Stuart Barnes was our captain. And it's the only time really when you sort of say, they might be better than us. They might be better in the back line than us and better running, but we've got to do this to beat them. And we managed to beat them. And then we, as part of your thing, you got a ticket to go and watch the big game next door. And we sat in the end and watched that game. And England were a very, very good team. So, you know, back-to-back Grand Slams. And France, you could just see them, as England got control of it in the second half, you could just see them lose it. And Lascoubet went off, and the hooker, it always looked like he was one step away from total meltdown, was Vincent Moscato, wasn't it? And they both went off. And yeah, it was just bedlam. And it was 93. It changed. They sort of, I don't know what if they did internally. They just seemed to sort of learn their lesson or try and tone it down a bit.
New coach, new system.
Yeah, maybe. I can't remember. Did Brock, he got sacked after 91, didn't he?
Yeah, I think there was a managerial change sort of.
He had the referee by his...
when he had the referee apparently in the tunnel, yeah. Propped up, you know, and he said, oh, I was just congratulating him on a good game.
By the throat.
So let's go to 93. You make your debut. And as you say, been on the scene, playing England B and stuff. But, you know, I know this is how probably 10 years on, second rows would have felt coming into a side with you and your guys in it. But your pack that day, Martin, Leonard, Moore, Probyn, Teague, Winterbottom, Clark, Bayfield, going up against a French side with Benazzi, Rouma, Caban, Cessignon, Saint-André, Sella, Cambrabero. It must have given you a few butterflies walking into that kind of international environment.
Oh, yeah, because that was a big game. And it was the opening game of the tournament. I came in to replace Wade Dooley, you know, one of the most iconic England players of that era, into the biggest European game of rugby there is really at that point. The good thing is I only had 24 hours notice. So I got called in on the Friday, so there was no time to really get too nervous. I didn't have to deal with all that media sort of speculation and people talking to you about it. I was just down in the hotel. You're playing tomorrow. Get your head around that, kid. The team were great. Of course they wanted Wade Dooley playing, but they didn't give me any of that vibe, obviously. And you go out and play, and Benazee was in the second row, wasn't he? And Rouma had a good game against Olivier. I'd seen him play in New Zealand in 89. They came on tour, and he was playing six, but he was suddenly this big French second row, tall, line-out sort of guy, which they hadn't really had much of. And he was a handful, you know, he was a handful for that whole decade. And he gave us a bit of a hard time, if I remember, in that my debut. But Benazee was a great athlete, but not a second row. And he wasn't used to some of the nuances of the front of the line out. And I managed to win some ball against him. So I sort of managed to do okay in that game. But we were two tries down early. Mm. They kicked it in the air. John Webb had a bit of they scored. This is a double Grand Slam winning team. And we're suddenly two tries down at Twickenham in the opening game of the tournament. And I'm thinking, is it me?
Yeah, because Slams in 91 and 92.
Yeah,
yeah.
And they came back to win. We won by a point, but it was weird because
Ian Hunter off the post, wasn't it?
Yeah. Ian Hunter scored off a. I got a bit of a head knock in that, so I don't remember a lot of it. But I remember afterwards, the team was very, very disappointed with their performance. You know, they didn't feel they played well at all. It's great to win, and I'm sitting there thinking, how did I do? Was I okay? I knew Wade was going to come back in. You know, he was fit. He was going to come back in for the rest of the tournament. But it was sort of the end of the era of that team. Mm. A lot of them were holding out for the 93 Lions. A lot still played, but it got refreshed a bit over the next couple of years. Some of the, you know, Jeff Probyn's last year. John Webb didn't play again after that. Peter Winterbottom's last year. Mike Teague's last year. So I got to play with some of those greats. But the weird thing when you're playing, when you make your debut, I was 22, you're playing against guys I've watched through the 80s, right? So you're playing against all these guys you've seen as a schoolboy, and suddenly you're playing against them. You know,
weird. Must have been weird.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. But you have to get over it because then you realise, you know, they're all players. They're all good. The level's up there. And you think, you know, if you've got anything about you, you think, right, I can do this, but I've got to get better at, you know, X, Y, and Z, everything. I mean, literally, I didn't train with the team all week. I wasn't there. You know, just get out on the field and have a go. I mean, just unthinkable today.
So that's 93, and it's remiss of me not to have at least mentioned Saint-André in 91. I mean, what's often forgotten with that try is that England won the Slam.
Yeah, that year.
But that was, you know, that try. I mean, if you have not seen that, when Blanco runs it out, Cambrabero chips over the head and
cross kick
from Cambrabero, and Saint-André depends on the bounce, he's under the post. Honestly, one of the greatest tries
I've got his shirt.
Anyone's ever seen.
I've got his shirt from that game, my debut. I've got
your shirt.
Saint-André's shirt.
Oh, yeah. From 93?
Yeah, because Rory gave me, he said, keep your shirt, and he gave me Saint-André's shirt. Yeah.
Oh, that's so nice.
Yeah, it's cool.
That's a nice touch. Okay, so 93 England win, and 94 and 95 as part of a slam, and 31-10 in 95.
Yeah.
That one must have felt pretty good, not to win, but to win by a bit.
Well, it was a big game again, obviously, and yeah, we played well. And it was a good game in the sunshine at Twickenham. scored, Mike Catt, fullback. I think we got through on the right-hand side and scored. And that was then, what's that, six consecutive wins in the tournament?
Well, it was part of eight in a row. England went from 89 to 95.
Yeah, one of them. Seven in the tournament and one in the World Cup. And then, I remember one of the journalists saying to the French coach, it might have been Babizia, I can't remember, oh, will you ever beat England again? One of those. And then, of course, they go on the run of, they beat us in the 95 third place playoff game, and we didn't win again until 99.
Yeah, so tell us about 96. Castagnier drop goal in Paris.
It was post-World Cup, so the teams are very different, you know. Again, a bit transitional, quite inexperienced. Lost some big name. You know, Rob Andrews not playing, Brian Moore's not playing. Dean Richards is not playing, I don't think. And we go there. Yeah, and it was, I can't remember a lot about the game, but we were right in it, obviously, until he dropped a goal. That's the only game we lost in that.
And that celebration with his tongue
out. See that at the time.
You wouldn't have seen it, but everyone on TV.
But he was, you know, if you talk to Thomas, he was saying, well, I was just this little squirt that no one, he's not a big guy at all, but very, very skillful. And that, he tells a story about one of the journalists not thinking, one of the TV, it was a TV reporter, not thinking he was a player. Because he was that small relative to everyone else. But yeah, but that was the last, that the last game in the, was the last game we played at the Parc des Princes for England against France.
So they broke the run, yeah, as you say, they broke the run in the third place in 95, but then went three in a row in 96, 97, 98.
We should have won 97. We got ahead, Lawrence scored, and we didn't control the game, and they somehow, I still don't know how they won that, really.
But they went back to back. This is the thing, you know, no one has done it since them, 97 and 98. I know England did it in 91 and 92, but the last team to do it, France in 97, 98, you know, Sadorni, Dominici, the late Dominici, Castagnier, Palouse, De Lievremont, Olivier Mann. Do you think they've been a bit under, maybe by, you know, us and across the channel, a bit underrated? Because that's a hell of an achievement going.
Yeah, they were good. They were a good team. Got to the World Cup final in 99. Like 98 was the opening game again, and we went there. We just got a draw with the All Blacks, and I think what France are very good at, what they can do in their rugby, not club games or whatever, is they can come out, particularly at home, and just hit the ground running at a super warp speed. And if you're not ready for it, they can get ahead very quickly and suddenly you're behind the game. And that happened in 98. And before we've sort of got into the game, you're a little bit out of it. You know, they're disappointing because you think we can compete with these guys. They've come out all guns blazing. I mean, I played a club game there in 96. You know, people are used to, Europe's been going on for nearly 30 years, European club rugby. But when we first went in 96, it was totally novel. We didn't play the French clubs ever. So we went over to Pau. And you look back now, we were sitting in the square on the Friday drinking coffee. Pau's a beautiful town in the Pyrenees. The sun was out late autumn. You're thinking, this is what European rugby's all about. Got beautiful boutique shops. They've all bought a nice sweater. They're having a nice coffee. This is the life, isn't it? Oh my God. They got us on the Saturday afternoon for 25 minutes. They blew us off the park lightly. They blew us off the park. And we had a good team. We were full of internationals up front. They scrummaged us. They destroyed us. Everything. We were hanging on by our fingernails. And guys still talk about this game. And the volatility of the place, the crowd, the passion was unbelievable. And we hung on. We managed to hang on into the second half and come back and fight our way back into it. And we had a young lad on the wing who went 60 yards to score. We got ahead. And the ref disallowed a try. It was a forward pass in the last minute for them to score. Would have won them a game. He disallowed it. It was a Scotsman. Fair play. They went bananas. they had to bring the metal cage over the tunnel going back into the stand. It was like nothing we'd ever seen. And in terms of just the passion, because they do not lose, you know, to lose at home for them is the ultimate disgrace, you know. And guys still talk about it. Winning that game is one of the best wins of my career. And we went back that night, in the evening, they put a marquee up and they had a dinner for us. And it wasn't a, you know, black tie and all, it was supporters in trestle tables, beer. It was brilliant.
They still have that now in France, that community feel with the players and the fans.
The best night, it was one of those nights where you know, guys still talk about the whole thing and the evening's part of it. And I was back there years later, and Robert Papin-Bourg had a bar. I think he owned a bar there in the famous French prop. I was back there years later with some mates. We were cycling in Pau, and we walked past this place. And I said, I've got vague memories of this place being here at some distant time in the past, in the 20th century. And we walked past it about 20 yards. I had a tap on my shoulder. And the guy who now ran it was the second row who played against me. Because we went back there 2 years later. Oh, we played there the next year. We played him a few times, actually. And he tapped me on the shoulder. Martin, come into the bar. And he had my shirt. We'd changed shirts. He had my shirt on the wall and all this stuff. So it's a passionate rugby place. But in a way that, you know, it's not Anglo-Saxon. It's different. Mm. And that's the beauty of it all.
And do you think, just before we do a few more games going into the Six Nations era, but the rivalry itself between England and France, it's a different type of rivalry to, you know, Sam Warburton talks about England-Wales being a bit big brother, little brother.
Greg Townsend talks
about the Calcutta Cup being the biggest game for a Scot. But England-France, for both sides, is it because they're the two, you know, biggest nations, biggest player pools, similarities in that sense, but also so many differences culturally as well?
The rival goes back away, doesn't it? Before we even played sport, we used to play them at other
things. Yeah, 1815 and all that, yeah.
Well, and that's the last time we, you know, is it the Entente Cordiale or whatever we got with them? But, yeah, I mean, they're our neighbours. Your rivals... Your closest rivals are always your biggest neighbours, aren't you? Because we've been, you know, to-ing and fro-ing, going over there for hundreds and hundreds of years. So now we just do it on the sporting field. And actually, the rugby rivalry, the football rivalry wasn't as big. They weren't as big a football nation, really, historically. And we don't play them annually either. So the England-France rugby thing is a huge... You know, it's what we play them at. So it's a great rivalry. Particularly if you're down in the southwest of Rugby Heartland, I had a friend who emigrated down there, and I've gone to see him, and I'm walking down through some town. You know, I've been on the street 2 minutes, and some guys grab me off the, you know, grab me into a cafe. What are you doing here? And blah blah blah. You know, they know their rugby, they love their rugby. I think of all the games, it was always because of at that time they were the two best teams. But even now, it just. When you talk England France, it just gives you a tingle because you know there's a chance these guys, if they get going, they're gonna pull your pants down big time. You know, we've all been chasing back with the crowd going berserk, thinking, oh my god, they're ripping us to pieces.
Yeah, and last year at Twickenham, case in point. Right, loads more to come on England France, the rivalry after this.
The drama.
They're having to be separated. They've both been shown the red card.
The entertainment. The superstars.
Foden! Oh, yes! What a goal.
Welcome to the Planet Premier League podcast. I'm Mark Chapman, and every week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua and myself talk all things Premier League.
They have this dynamism and this quality that they can play anywhere. They need to prove themselves in scoring more and more and more goals.
I think if they don't win the title this year, the season is a failure in the league.
Planet Premier League. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Five Lives Rugby Union Daily.
Okay, so Martin Johnson, we've had the French dominance in the 80s. We've had the English dominance, eight in a row, from 89 to 95. France come back, win in 96, double up their slams in 97, 98. And then England and come Clive back. Woodward and Johnny Wilkinson.
Yeah.
Because Johnny kicked all the points in 99, sat down Emil Untermach famously in 2000, and then... One of your great performances at Twickenham in 01. Which one do you want to pick out? I don't think you played in 2000, did you?
No.
Achilles, yeah. But three really, really big wins against France in a row as you were building up to obviously what happened in 03.
Yeah, 99 was an interesting one because we hadn't beaten them for a long time. So they came to Twickenham. We didn't score a try. And we'd become a very strong defensive team. So we sat there afterwards. And we were quite sort of happy to win. And we, in a way... I think we conceded one, maybe. I think they scored one try that day. But we'd strangled them a bit defensively.
Seven Wilkinson pens, yeah.
And Clive was sort of happy that we'd won, but he was sort of, because he was an attacking player, he was an attacking mindset coach. But he was sort of like, oh, we've got to score some tries. And well, who cares, we've won. So, but it was a good win. Then 2000 was a big win because we hadn't won over there for 6 years. And Ian Bolshaw was in that team. Johnny, you know, relatively, after losing in the 99 World Cup, at that stadium, actually, the Stade, That was a big one. I was injured and missed it. I watched it on TV. It was a big win. It's always big to win in France. But then the next year, we were really, really flying. I remember they brought back Ebenezer, and he came out. People were saying, because we were scoring freely, and someone had said England was going to score 40 points or something to him. And he came out with a classic sort of French reply. And he's a great guy. They will have to run over our bodies.
Yeah.
They will have to run over our bodies to score 40 points. And actually at half time, I think they'd scored a couple of tries in that game. Philip Bernard Sales, really, really quick guy. But we were so fit and we had real pace in that team. Bolscher at full back, Jason Robinson coming off the bench. We just ran the legs off them in the second half. They just could not keep up with the... I think when you play France, and I think that's never more true than now, you've got to keep the pace of the game up. They are capable of playing at a very, very high pace, but you've got to go, right, fine, but we're keeping doing this. We're keeping going, and you've got to stress them that way, because they also always sort of wanted to play quick, then we'll have a bit of a break. Then we're going to go quick on our terms. And you go, no, we're going quick all the time, and we're going to take you into places. You've got to put them under pressure for all the time. But in 01, we just ran. The ref went off in that game. He was running. I think his legs just went.
Couldn't give up.
He just went off.
Because you were playing, I know 03 was when it all happened, and you didn't win the slam in 01 because of the foot and mouth going back to Lansdowne Road. And but Keith was
most points, most tries.
Yeah, that was when Bron Ashton was involved, wasn't he? Mike Catt in the midfield. You were playing probably the most attacking rugby.
We were just running people off their feet. Yeah. We were just running people off their feet. We had pace. Mike's passing.
Bolscher coming through.
But Bolscher. I mean, Ian Bolscher must have thought this international rugby is easy, isn't it? Just give me the ball. You know, we were running teams off their feet. And I was talking about the other day. I remember playing Scotland at home in that year. We're an hour in, and when you hit that 60-minute mark, particularly then before we're doing a lot of tactical subs, you know. You hit that hour mark and the game's been fast and brutal and people, that's when, and if you're behind at that point and it's not looking like you're going to come, you know, you've got a chance to come back, that's hard, that last 20 minutes, and then we'd bring Jason Robinson on. Mm-hmm. And he didn't really know where to be at that point, but there's still the very thought of him. I can remember looking at their faces when he came on and then thinking, oh, for God's sake. You know, they've got to now chase this guy.
A bit of a trump card, that wasn't it? Yeah.
It was a joker card because Jason, he didn't, you know, he very, very quickly did learn where to be. But so we were running teams off their feet, and I forget the score in 01, but it was 40 points, wasn't it? Mm. Hilly scored a great try where Richard Hill ran about
48-19.
He ran on a curve and sat on eagle. Their backs couldn't get to him. Austin chipped that ball over his head from nine, didn't he? Mike Catt scored. I mean, you're not borderline. You're taking them at that point. So we were just running them off their feet. That was a dominant win.
Yeah. So that was 01, and then didn't win the slam because of, you know, Ireland winning later that year and the foot and mouth delayed game. 02, you went to and, you know, we speak about Johnny Wilkinson's influence, kicking all the points in 99, sitting down Emma Lintermat with a real statement as a 10, tackling like that. But in 02... That was when Serge Betson did a number on Johnny. Has that been overblown? That kind of
they came out the trap pretty quick again. You know, we got complacent. You know, we would win in, and you think, oh, you know, we'll come and they came out. They came firing out and scored one or two early on before we'd really got ourselves in the game, putting us under pressure, getting Wilkinson. So it wasn't happening. You know, we had to rethink what we're trying to do. We came back in the second half. We probably should have won that game in the second half. I know we had it was a bit of a controversial moment in the second half when we were on the attack Jason scored, I think, the second half. We got right back into it. Lose by a point in the end, was it? 2 points, something? It was close-ish. But yeah, they did that thing where they just came out the blocks really quick. They were good. I mean, France. You play France, you get it wrong. They're gonna do you. So, yeah, they beat us fair and square. But it just felt, it's one of those games where you felt, we're not. You know, we didn't really hit the ground running there, and we've let ourselves down a little bit in terms of performance.
2015 final score in 02. So you've got a situation where England, Martin, have won in slams in 91, 92, 95. France have won slams in 97, 98, and then 02 and 04, and England in 03. There's all this
well, we look back and I remember talk of it kind of being, oh, is this a two-tiered championship? Should England-France always be on the final? Which obviously then was made to look silly by what happened through the noughties with Wales winning slams and Ireland winning slams and everything. But was that a real conversation to your memory that this is England-France and the rest?
In 2003, it was the opening game again at Twickenham, and it wasn't a great game. We didn't play particularly well. We'd just beaten... We'd had a great autumn and... We were a little bit flat, really, after a tremendous autumn. And we walked off. It was very similar to my debut in 93. We walked off. We'd won. I think we conceded 3-1 or something like that. But we won the game. And we just walked off like you'd lost. You know, the guys were just really not happy with the way they played, the performance. I think Will Greenwood said something like, you know, the worst wins he's ever played in, blah, 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 blah. You know, we'd be happy with a win right now like that. But, yeah, it was a weird one, really, that opening game in 2003.
Did you remember chat around?
The chat was exactly that. Well, this is ridiculous. This should be the last game of the tournament every year. This is the final played at the start of the tournament. This is the only game that matters. Oh, yeah, all of that conversation was going on. And then we actually ended up playing Ireland for the Grand Slam at the end of the season. So that it sort of disappeared very quickly after that. But yeah, at that point it was, being the opening game, it was seen as a waste, really.
Because it's a testament to how the Six Nations continues to be enduring. Because if you look at resource and playing numbers, England and France should, in terms of the raw metrics, they should be up there. But then you saw Wales winning slams in 5-8 and 12, and Ireland in 9-18, 22, quite possibly 24. So Six Nations continues to sort of go on these cycles, doesn't it? Even when at that point people would have gone, oh, it's going to be an England-France duopoly.
Yeah, and Ireland came through, and then within a few years, I mean, Wales, they had a terrible year in 2003, didn't they? They had a wooden spoon. I think when we played them, they'd lost in Italy. The next game, actually, that was the next game we played at Cardiff, and they'd lost in Italy. So, yeah, and then within, you know, through a couple of years, they're winning the championship and Grand Slam. So it goes round. I mean, France will always produce good players. You go and play them at club level, and you play guys you've never heard of, and they'd be like, wow, he's one of the best, you know, he's fantastic players. So they always produce good players. You just always think they've got to get themselves, and the game is far more organised now than ever it was, more structured. I think they were far more organised in what they did back in the day than we realised. I think we always thought they just play like the Welsh team of the 70s. They just come. No, the Welsh team of the 70s had squad sessions. You know, they had squad sessions in Wales. The French team, I think, I remember Rob Andrew going out there to play in Toulouse in the mid-90s, saying, no, they practice counter-attacking.
Right.
They practice counter-attacking.
It looked off the cuff.
Yeah. Like most things that look great, there's a bit of, they know what they're doing. This is what, and we never practiced counter-attacking, and it just wasn't a thing.
You know? Yeah. So we're through the noughties, slam, France 0-2, England 0-3, France 0-4, France 1-1. In 2010, when you were in charge of England,
we should have won that.
Really, you gave them a really good go. Because let's go back, just before we do that one, let's do 2009. That was...
We played well.
You won on a sunny Sunday afternoon, 34-10.
Well. Went the length of the field, one try. The boys played really well, yeah.
Still feel good, that one.
Yeah, okay, boys came good. And Dale Armitage had a heck of a game in that game. We should have won. We scored the only try the next year. We should have beaten them over there, and they were going for the Grand Slam.
And it was Chris Ashton's debut. You brought in a few.
Ben Foden put Chris in the corner. We got refereed off the park. It was Bryce Lawrence, New Zealand referee, got involved with the Grand Slam celebrations. It was a horrendous refereeing performance, if I can just put that on the record.
You've let it go, though.
Oh, no, it's horrendous. Horrendous.
They won the slam in 10.
Give them a World Cup semi-final.
But then, is that where, you know, the cliches about France, and, you know, they've struggled a bit this championship, but they've kind of really seemed to have got away from the cliche about what France are going to turn up. You never know what you're going to get, because 2011's World Cup is a great example of that. They were mutiny against their coach.
From nowhere, yeah.
And end up a kick away. Should have won the final, beat you in the quarters. Yeah. That was a classic example of what a French team can do when it's least expected. Were they really hard, therefore, to coach against and to prepare a team to play
against? Just got to assume they're going to be at their best. There's no point thinking, oh, they'll be this. You've just got to assume they'll be at their best, and that means you've got to have all hand, you know, you've all got to be totally alert for everything, because they've always traditionally, and the world is a smaller place, everyone watches everyone else play, the game is not played hugely differently around the world anymore because of that. But they would play the game in a different way. Their mindset is different. You know, I was having this conversation the other day. When you play a team, you look at what they've been through and you sort of try and predict their mindset. And normally you'll say, well, they've been through adversity. They'll come out and battle, but have they got confidence? Probably not. You know, you sort of put a bit of what we'd call our logic to it. Mm-hmm. I don't think that is the same there. It just isn't. You know, they have a different way of seeing things, which is great because it makes, you know, it gives the world a bit of, be all boring if we were all the same. So I think my brother played there and he said, you know what? They can play great one day for no reason. And the next day they'll play terrible for no reason. And when you least expect it.
And do you think that's still the case today?
I think it's in their psyche a little bit. It's just different to how we see things. I think we, you know, reliability is we put a big thing on that. You know, this guy will turn up in our sporting. Oh, this guy, you know, oh, he's a solid professional. He'll turn up and do his job, whatever. You know, you'll be consistent. We put a, you know, you can rely on this guy. I think for them, that's probably not quite as high on the list. And I was watching an interview with a guy. What sport was it? It was a cyclist. It was a cycling director sportif, they call them, you know, the manager of the cycling team. And he was talking about his team. He's in tears in the interview. He's got tattoos all over his body for his cycling team that he manages, you know. And for us, you're going, you're a little bit possibly over the edge here, kid. You're a little, you know. But that's what they're like. Their passion is and that I think that can produce tremendous things, and it can produce tremendous things the other way.
Yeah.
I think they have that, and it's part of them. And like you say, God bless them for it, because it makes things very different. So I think they did try, you know, when we had that success against them, particularly in 2003, on that rainy day in the semi-final, when they said, oh, it started raining, and they, you know, they didn't fancy it. Well, and the English would have played us, what was the expression? I think Ibanez used it, didn't he? What, the English would have played us on the stadium roof if they had to, something like that, or in the car park. We won that game after 35 minutes, half time. We were like, we've got these.
You knew?
Yeah.
Psychologically.
Unless they turn something on that they haven't shown, but they, you know, we're on top. You know, it was weird. So, yeah, I think that's still part of them. I think the way the game is, yeah, it's a bit less, but I still think that's part of their psyche. They are different, and as I said, thank goodness for it.
Because even though a lot of it's probably different and cleaned up and modernised, you still watch French club rugby, and the coaches are going at each other on the side. Brody Two's absolutely, you know, it's just crazy.
The passion of it all is huge and tremendous. And we'd say, if you said to someone, "Now you're getting emotional now," you'd say it as in a way of calm down a bit, because you're getting emotional. Where I don't know if that expression's in there. Psyche, because that's just what they are. Maybe it's just what they are. And you've got to love it, because rugby is an emotional game. It is an emotional game. And it's, you know, they've produced some of the great rugby of our lifetimes, haven't they? We can think of looking at their players and some of the great tries. They went down, you know, we beat them in 94 in France. You know, we were both okay. Then they went down and beat the All Blacks twice.
Mm.
Who would have ever, you know, they scored the try from the end of the world. They call it down there.
Yeah. I think that's better than the Saint-André, just about.
Yeah, but we,
they're both special.
In that era, we didn't see that as much, because it wasn't all over our TV like it is now. But yeah, they went down and beat the All Blacks in New Zealand, and well, how, the hardest thing to do. So they can just produce stuff at any point. So I think when you play them, you just assume they're going to be very, very good.
2011 is a great example of that, wasn't it? You know, should have lost the semi, should have won the final. Just to bring it to the modern day, so, you know, you won the title in 2011, you beat them then. Stuart Lancaster's England beat them 12, 13 and 15. Eddie Jones' England beat them 16, 17, 19, and 19 at Twickenham was when, I think,
They were terrible.
They were terrible.
Yeah, that was hard to watch.
Yeah, Johan Huger was fullback and run around the place with
that
the
kicking. That was hard to watch.
And that was almost when I think French rugby said, right, enough now.
Lowest point, yeah.
Let's try and turn it around. That was quite a pivotal day, if you remember that one.
Yeah, I do. I remember watching it. I was up at BBC Studios in Manchester. That was on. Yeah, it was not nice to watch because the world needs the French being the French in rugby terms. You need it. You know, the world of rugby needs that. Needs them being good. Their crowd had fallen out of love with the national team at that point.
Because you'd go to the stadium and you'd sense it, wouldn't you?
They had fallen out of love with the national team, which was not great. We know they can be up and down as well and fickle, but at least they were. You know, they were passionate about it. But you know, I think Ibanez and Galtier really did a great job of getting them back on track. And you know, the heartache of their home World Cup and not getting beyond the quarterfinal is probably difficult. Again, you know, we go, right, okay, get over that, come back, Baba Strongi, yes.
Easier said than done.
Yeah, and they will feel it. And I didn't think they played badly in that opening game, you know. I didn't think they played too badly, but Ireland were very, very good. Ireland had got over their disappointment, and they knew that was their biggest game of the tournament, and they had to hit the ground running, and they did all of that, and they got ahead in that game. And I think... Yeah, where France are right now is probably, as ever, difficult for us to fathom.
I thought we'd cracked them. I thought we'd had France cracked as a really good team. You know, and I think the high point maybe of the Galtier regime up to now, after that slam in 22, was that Twickenham game last year, 53-10.
Talking of difficult to watch.
Does the phrase, sorry, good game, mean anything to you? Sorry, good game?
No.
It's a French thing. Paul Edison, who's been a guest on the pod, was telling me about it. So apparently what Will Carling... It might be apocryphal. Apparently, after the 90s, when England were winning 8 in a row, he'd go up to the French players and go, sorry, good game. And so the French...
So apologise for winning.
Almost just an English... Quite a sort of British thing.
Sorry about that.
Sorry, good game. Yeah, exactly. Sorry, good game, chap. And their French fans were singing in the stands during the 53-10. Sorry, good game, sorry. And so it's become a bit of a sort of a cult reference.
Yeah, yeah.
So France now, when they do beat England, would say, sorry, good game.
Did he think he was mocking them? Or not.
Maybe a bit of lost in translation. It's maybe something that's become a bit of mythology. But part of the rivalry, I think.
When you shake a guy's hand, you empathise with how, if you've won, you empathise with how he's feeling.
Yeah.
Because to do anything else is to gloat a little bit. And that's not what you do after a game. You shake the hand and you give them that sort of, you know...
Hard luck.
That little shrug and, you know... Sorry about that. It is.
But I think it's a British thing to do, and I think the French, because at that point it was 8 in a row, and it was Carling's England, and it was everything.
We've smashed you again. Sorry, Joe.
You know, Battle of Waterloo, Spirit of Waterloo. You know, do you know what I mean? It was all that kind of, there were probably historical and cultural connotations.
Yeah, yeah. Like what Thomas did, you wouldn't have seen a guy, an English player, do that in that era.
The little tongue out.
And yeah, but you sort of get it, right? He's a cheeky little French chap. It's okay. We'll get you. If there's a chance to get you, we'll take it. And at the end of it, we'll go.
But the cultural differences make the rivalry, as we talked
about.
Yeah,
of course. Yeah. Of course. You know, they the French should be there. The cockles were running all over the field at the Parc de Prance. You know, it's the band. I mean, whenever you played in France, the band, you know, the band would be playing up, and that trumpet, whatever it is, the things blaring away, and it's part of, you know, the England-France thing. We don't, you know, we are different. And, you know, as you say, God bless it, because that makes the world go round.
Yeah, no one quite knows the origin of Le Crunch. It's either from an Irish newspaper, or it's from an Apple advert, some people reckon it's gone back to the 1900s.
Nah, I don't think they would have taught Le Crunch, would they, in those days? I think the first time I heard it was the mid-90s.
Mm.
95, that was the first time I heard it. Now, whether it was around before that, I don't know. But I don't know. You don't know what went on back then. But it's a great, you know, the whole tournament is a great thing. It's such tradition. I always gauge, you know, my mates who are not rugby fans. I get their sense of it, because rugby guys have an opinion on stuff. I get their sense of it, because for a lot of guys, it's the only rugby they'll watch. It's on terrestrial TV, thank goodness, still. It's a great thing, and the England France thing is, you know, being an Englishman, it's always been the rivalry. I treasure my French shirts I've swapped more than any others.
Really?
Yeah, because they're just the coolest ones. There's something about them that's just cool. Got the golden cockerel on there. They're just the coolest shirts, you know.
Well, something about French rugby that's cool.
Different. It's different. It's different. I mean, they're you were talking about Les Cabora from the mid-80s, you know. He's this dude, you know, dropping goals from all over the place, running the ball, Blanco, all of them. I mean, Rodriguez, there was just something. You'd see them in the tunnel, they were lined up there, swarthy, like 3 days of growth on. You know, just, wow. These boys are gonna do something.
Yeah, and just finally, it's often said by, you know, Sam Warburton was saying how England's the biggest game for a Welsh player. Gregor Townsend on our rivalry series saying that England, Scotland's the biggest game for the Scots. For an England player, are they all therefore the same? Or is the France slightly different for the reasons you've discussed?
For my era, my generation, yeah, France was the big... France was, without being arrogant, you're expected in our era to win those others, right? And if you lost them, you'd hear about it. So you didn't want to lose any of them, obviously. But the France game was when you were playing. As I said, I can remember being in team meetings when, you know, and the players would take the meetings and they'd say, I remember one of them saying, look, as a back line, they're quicker than us. You know, it's the only time you ever say these guys have got more pace than we have. Yeah, and you see back line with Rory and Jerry Guscott and all these guys, some good athletes in there. So you knew they were always dangerous. You know, even if they weren't going through a great run of form, they're always, always dangerous. Because they conceded, you know, that 91 try, they'd seen, you know, we've all seen them do it when we've played against them. We've seen them do it when you were watching it on TV as a kid. So for me, the England-France game was always, always huge. Going over there, you'd fly to Charles de Gaulle on a Thursday sort of afternoon. By the time you got out, it's always that long trek through traffic into Paris to the hotel. And then it was just, everything was different. You know, we didn't go abroad as often then. You didn't play abroad. You didn't play rugby in France. That was once every 2 years if you were in the test team. That was it. So everything was very, very different and potentially just explosive in every sense.
Brilliant. Great way to finish, Martin. It's been a real pleasure to get all your views on this great fixture. I think that's what we found doing this rivalry series is every rivalry very different, really special in their own ways, which makes the Six Nations so enduring and so unique. Saturday night, Lyon, 8 o'clock kickoff, 5 live, BBC Sounds, all the best coverage. You won't miss a thing with us. Rugby and Daily back tomorrow. Cheers.
On the Football Daily Podcast,
the Women's Football Weekly.
With me, Ellen White.
Ellen White coming forward.
Ben Haynes with some of the biggest names in the WSL joining us every week to discuss everything that's happening in the women's game.
Right after the World Cup, got told, we're going to America. I thought, amazing. 10 days in training, did my meniscus, and the next day they flew to America.
Blocked header 6 yards out, Ellen White!
The Women's Football Weekly Podcast.
New episodes every Wednesday.
Subscribe to the Football Daily on BBC Sounds.